From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Thanksgiving can be such a joy, a challenge, a triumph, a mess, and it's coming right up now. My guest today, Sam Sifton, is something of a Thanksgiving connoisseur. He loves it. He's cooked for it a lot. He's been the hotline helper for others when it all went wrong. Now he's laying out the can't-lose road to a fine feast. This hour, On Point, Thanksgiving guru Sam Sifton's dish-by-dish advice on the great Thanksgiving meal. You can join the conversation. What's your Thanksgiving magic, your Thanksgiving pitfall? What makes the day for you on the table or around it? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Lots of people doing some shopping this weekend for the holiday coming right up next week. It can be wonderful. It can be crazy. Here's a little episode from Cheers, 1986. The regulars from the bar gathered at Carla's house for Thanksgiving. Carla, played by Rhea Perlman, loses her patience when Norm George Wendt struggles to turn his frozen turkey into a Thanksgiving meal.
Look, I'm sorry, guys. A little pop thing won't pop out. There's something wrong with it.
Something wrong with you.
I think something's wrong with your oven, Carla.
Hey, my oven was just fine until you stuffed Birdzilla in it.
Birdzilla's in the oven and the laugh track is on. We all pray for that. Later this hour, we'll hear from Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Rick Bragg on memories of grace and Thanksgiving. But first, joining us now from New York is Sam Sifton. He's food columnist for the New York Times Magazine, former restaurant critic and dining editor for the paper. He spent some years as the paper's Thanksgiving Day hotline guy. He's national editor now for the New York Times. His new book is Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. Sam Sifton, welcome to On Point. Wonderful to have you here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
We're going to get right down into the gravy and the, what does he call it? Not the funk, the funge, the fung, the fong, the...
The fond.
The fond. We'll get even down into the really gooey guts of the gravy here. Sam, help us before we dive in. There's a lot of kitchen lore and learning we can do here, but give us a sense of where you come from on Thanksgiving. What's your kind of Thanksgiving history? Are you one of those far-out guys, traditional? Is it a big family affair, small? What's your take on Thanksgiving?
Well, I'm a traditionalist when it comes to Thanksgiving, and that's what this book is really about. As you noted at the top of the hour, this is a holiday that is filled with a lot of stress for a lot of people, and that stress is compounded by those of us in the media who each year come forward with new and exciting ways to cook the turkey and new and exciting side dishes to go along with it. And what this book argues is... And that's not really what we should be doing at Thanksgiving. It's very rare in America now for people to be cooking for 12 or 15 or 20 people except at Thanksgiving. And so when the feast arrives, there are a lot of hosts and a lot of cooks who to put it plainly, freak out in the face of Birdzilla. And don't know quite what to do. And what I'd like to encourage this Thanksgiving and in future Thanksgivings is that we concentrate on these fundamentals, on making a beautiful burnished roast turkey, on nailing our mashed potatoes, on making sure that the dressing or stuffing, as we call it in New England, is just crisp on the outside and moist and delicious on the inside, that we have an apple pie, that we take the sort of Rockwellian ideal of Thanksgiving and make it real in our own different ways all across the country.
How did you become a or the Thanksgiving cook? And what kind of settings did that come to you, Sam?
Well, like many journalists, I have some issues with authority. And I,
you're talking to me, baby.
As a young lad in college, I rebelled against my loving family, whom I love very much to this day, and decided that I would stay at college and have Thanksgiving on my own. This was my adolescent move out of the house.
Right.
And I have to tell you, Tom, that first Thanksgiving that we made in Cambridge was just transcendent to me. To make this giant turkey and have it turn out so well, to have a group of friends gathered around the table to eat these traditional foods made by knucklehead punk rock 19-year-olds was an amazement to me. And from that point forward, I declared myself devoted to this holiday above all others.
I do love it myself, and I have to say it's the one where I am the central cook in our house as well, and love that role. You take us back to the very beginning. Remind us about that 1621 Plymouth Plantation meal. Remind us what that one was and wasn't, Sam.
Well, this was not perhaps a meal that we'd like to recreate today. If you think about the land and waters near Plymouth Rock, you know that you're not going to find any heritage turkeys strutting about. The meal was heavy on sea duck and some gourds and squash and the like. Sea duck, I don't know if you've ever eaten sea duck.
Can't say I have knowingly.
It's an acquired taste. I think you would remember it. It's a bird that the meat of which looks like roast beef and tastes a little bit like sardines. So it's a complicated flavor.
Where's my white meat turkey? Right.
That's right. This first Thanksgiving was a long, long way from the Norman Rockwell Thanksgiving that we think of as the idealized Thanksgiving today.
And with Abraham Lincoln so much on our minds these days, as the movie comes out, everybody thinking about Lincoln, you remind us, he was the one who turned it into a national day of Thanksgiving, 1863. What were the circumstances there, Sam?
Well, you know, a nation in deep crisis and a president who could step forward to say, we are going to set this day aside to give thanks for our harvest, our health, our bounty. It's sort of astonishing that could be done. Of course, he was a good enough writer and a good enough rhetorician that it worked.
In the Civil War, you remind us, he said he wanted to do it in part to just remind people, to return our people's notions of peace, harmony, tranquility, and union. Do something, act it out to sort of bring those back to mind, please, said Abe.
Yes, he did. And I think we strive in many of our Thanksgivings to do just that. Tranquility is a tough one once everyone's in the house and the dogs are barking and the children are running around.
Yeah.
But taking the long view, taking the wide view, there is a stillness to America on Thanksgiving Day that I think is worth remarking upon and worth celebrating. I'm deeply worried as a Thanksgiving guru about what is happening with these stores opening earlier and earlier and earlier, the big box stores.
Yes, please don't eat into this one. Hold that thought. We'll come back to that. That's a kind of is that a desecration? Maybe it is. We don't want to go there yet. But here we are. It's Friday, and Thanksgiving is next Thursday. And let's just start with the bird itself. In your ideal radar of the meal coming together, where's the bird at this point? Is it still frozen somewhere? Is it fresh somewhere? Is it in your freezer, your fridge? When's the bird make its appearance?
You, Tom, are going to pick up your bird this weekend, perhaps on Sunday. It will be, I'm deciding, a fresh bird, which means that it will be very close to frozen. It'll be quite cold, but it won't actually have seized up, and you are going to take it home lovingly and put it in the fridge. Now, we can talk about whether we're going to brine it or not. If we are going to, I'm inviting myself to your home for Thanksgiving.
Okay.
If we are going to brine this bird, we're going to do that on Monday night. And
if I'm not brining, is it all right in that near frozen state, plopped in the fridge
fine until
Thursday?
It's fine. It's sitting in there. It's great. It's probably in some kind of a bag. We're going to want to get it out of the bag on Wednesday after work. We're going to cut it out. We're going to rinse it. We're going to take the nasty bits in there, the giblets that we'll use or giblets that we will use for various things the next day, the neck, which will go into a stock. And then we're going to rinse the bird, clean the bird with water, and now we're going to aggressively dry it with paper towel again and again and again, and then allow the bird to sit naked as a jaybird in the refrigerator overnight to dry. The reason I want a dry bird is so that when it goes into the oven on Thursday morning, the oven heat doesn't have to do any work evaporating water on it before it sets to work
on that
bronzing the skin.
Roasting.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
So
and there it
your
will
bird
be.
Is yet to arrive.
All right. And you're saying fresh, but a lot of people are going to have frozen. Maybe they don't even have access to fresh someplace.
That's true. And I want to be clear about this, that those frozen birds that you get at the supermarket or that your friendly neighborhood drug dealer hands out off the back of a truck in an effort to curry favor with the residents of the town, those aren't bad turkeys. Those are the turkeys we know from truck stops and diners all across this country, and they can be okay. I don't advocate for that sort of farming necessarily, but I'm not here to judge on Thanksgiving Day.
Okay, Sam, hold it right there. We're going to come back to that bird sitting naked in the fridge. It's Wednesday night. You've got us that far. Sam Sifton's new book is Thanksgiving: How to Cook It Well. We've got recipes from his book at our website, onpointradio.org. It's a real nice kind of blend of kitchen wisdom and just social family wisdom for Thanksgiving Day and the meal. Here's Mary Chapin Carpenter. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Grateful for what's understood and all that is forgiven. We try so hard to be good, to lead a life worth living. Father, mother, daughter, son, neighbor, friend, and friends, all together, everyone, let grateful days be endless. Grateful for each hand we hold, gathered round this table.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about turkey and all the trimmings, advice for the Thanksgiving kitchen and beyond with Thanksgiving connoisseur and guru, Sam Sifton. His lovely new little book is Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. And there's good advice in here and good recipes. It's traditional. He likes it tasty. He likes it, he's not out on the edge of the latest Thanksgiving trend. But if you want to do it in the old-fashioned way, up to date, he's got it for you right there. Joins us today from New York. Here's a little piece from the 2000 film Pieces of April. April Burns uses her neighbor's oven to cook the turkey. The neighbors ask about her Thanksgiving menu, and there is judgment.
Turkey, gravy, a Waldorf salad.
Oh, Waldorf salad. That sounds unusual.
It's made with different kinds of fruits and nuts, and the dressing's pretty much mayonnaise. And then mashed potatoes, of course, and, well, cranberry sauce, which is easy. Just open the can.
Yvette.
Oh, sweetie.
I like it from the can.
Nobody likes it from the can.
I like it from the can. Nobody likes it from the can. And so it begins. We'll get to the cranberries. Sam Sifton is with us from New York. Sam, a couple of calls. People listening already. We'll get to that bird that's waiting for us in the fridge. Lorelei's calling from Sherburn, Massachusetts. Hi, Lorelei. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I stress, but I welcome the stress because it's the one meal a year that I can kind of pull out all the stops. And while I appreciate a traditional meal, I kind of think outside the box a little bit on Thanksgiving. And I'm on my way right now to reserve my organic turkey for the special day.
All right, nice. So you stress, but you like the stress.
Yeah, I welcome it because it's my chance to kind of shine and make a meal for, we have friends, not so much family, but make a meal that, sort of pushes the envelope a little bit and fills us all up for days.
Hey, I love it. And it's fun to spend a whole day cooking something that we rarely get to do. I adore that. One more, if I may, Sam. Thanks, Lorelei. Robert in Darlington, South Carolina. Darlington, Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
Well, our Thanksgiving is taking a turn of trying to be like a little more traditional. We do the bird. We deep fry. We'll do duck and goose if we can get a hold of it. We've taken out all the cheap processed carbohydrates and do like a three-meat stuffing for the birds or the ducks, whatever's being roasted. Mushrooms, a lot of legumes, we do away with all the potato and mayonnaise. You know, we try to apples, nuts. We do things that we think were available back then.
Oh, I love it. I love it. I love it, Robert.
That sounds awesome.
It sounds just awesome. Sort of going for what was then, out with the cheap carbs. We'll look at carbs. There's carbs in Sam's lineup here. Talk about getting what's out there, Sam. Thank you, Robert. Kelt writes to us, Robert. Used to date a guy who would go turkey hunting right before Thanksgiving. It was good. Strong taste to it, she writes, but I never found it to be gamey, similar to pheasant. He said the best place to bag one was near a stand of oaks, so they fed on the acorns. He would smoke it. Haven't had one in many years, though. I'm going to get to your roasting magic here. Amanda in Castleton, Vermont. Amanda, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
I raise heritage bourbon red turkeys. This is my first year doing it. Okay. They went to slaughter on November 3rd, and I did have to freeze them. Okay. I was wondering how he would prepare that bird.
I love a bourbon red. I think that's
take
a
us
great...
there, Sam. Take us. I don't know. Right from the slaughterhouse.
Well, let's take our frozen bourbon red home. That's a delicious turkey. You know, it doesn't look much like those commercial birds. You know, it's longer and leaner. There's more dark meat on it and a lot more flavor. So the first and most important thing is that we need to thaw that bird, and we're going to pick it up. We're going to be up there, Amanda, tomorrow morning to get our frozen bird, and we'll put it in the fridge. And just leave it there until Wednesday, and it will come off from its frozen state and be kind of ready to go by Wednesday. You can sometimes hurry up the thawing process by submerging the frozen bird in water, in cold water, and then recycle that water and keeping it cold. But you don't want to hurry it too much. I think that the process of freezing the bird should be released slowly.
Okay.
That is to say, over time. When I was running the New York Times Thanksgiving help desk, I would get a lot of panic calls on Thursday morning saying, what do I do with this frozen?
Rock solid
turkey. And I would ask them where they lived. And when they told me where they lived, I would look around and find them a good Chinese restaurant where they could get a meal that day. Because
right.
There's not much you can do on Thanksgiving Day with a rock-solid frozen bird.
Well, give it time. Let's say Amanda's got her red bourbon heritage turkey. It's thawed. It's Thursday morning. Now we're ready to go to the oven. Take us there, Sam.
Well, I actually might deep fry that bird. But let's go to the oven. We're going to just treat it pretty simply to allow that heritage flavor to shine. So we're going to rub it inside and out with some butter. Remember, that skin is really dry. We're going to rub it inside and out with butter, salt and pepper it. I might throw an onion into the cavity in there. Mm-hmm. And then we'll get it into the oven. We'll give it an initial blast of heat at about 425 for a half hour to seize it up tight. And then we'll crank the oven back down lower into the 325 range, 350 range, mm-hmm. and let it just hum along until she's done.
Are you a baster or not a baster?
Oh, I'm absolutely a baster. Basting is key to an excellent skin. And after that first half hour of high heat, another half hour goes by, it's going to start to give off its fat and give us some basting liquid. Now, I'm serious about butter at Thanksgiving. So while I'm waiting for the turkey to exude its juices and fats and give me something to baste with, I am not beneath hurrying it along with some melted butter that I will paint onto it as a baste as we go.
I remember a Thanksgiving where there got to be too much butter too soon. It drained down into that pan and was burning, and the poor bird had to come back out before it even got going on that golden burnished skin.
That is a Thanksgiving tragedy.
Yes. Yes. So you're waiting for it to sort of release its own stuff. But are you also adding liquid to the pan, Sam?
I do sometimes, particularly on a leaner bird. You could put some turkey stock into the pan, or a glass of wine into the pan, some water into the pan to create a kind of moist environment in which to cook. But I think we have to be careful about this, because I find that too much humidity in the oven leads to a kind of limpness to the skin that I don't like.
Okay, the bird's in. She's going along. We're going to baste her once in a while by your lights. And now what else are we working on here?
Well, one of the things that I think we got to be careful about is temperature. This is one of the things that people really needlessly worry about during the Thanksgiving cooking process. In the 21st century, we have digital oven-safe thermometers that you can insert into the bird, best into the leg of the bird, mm-hmm. not touching the bone, and a wire runs out. I think some of them are wireless, but a wire runs out and up to a console that it's about the size of a pack of cards, and it sits next to the oven, and you can watch the temperature, the interior temperature of the bird rise to the 165 degrees at the thigh you want it to be at when you pull it out mm-hmm. of the oven. Mm-hmm. And I cannot emphasize enough the excellence of purchasing one of these things in advance of Thanksgiving, because it removes all the worry about
and opening and closing and twisting it around to find that thermometer and try and read it through the grease.
Yeah, and that's not a good look. And I should add those pernicious little pop-ups right. that we heard about in the Cheers segment at right. the top of the hour.
Right.
Those things are what happens is the popper comes up when a wax is melted at like 290 degrees. I mean, not literally. It melts, I think, when the interior of the bird reaches 180 degrees at the breast, at which point okay. everything is super dry and overdone.
Yeah, too far.
If one of those happens to be in your turkey, get rid of it.
You've got your all-important turkey stock going at this point. You've taken that neck, you've thrown it into a pot of water with some veggies, and tell us about it.
Well, I think that's the bare minimum of what you have to do or can do. Mm-hmm. It's generally what I do. I'll just take the neck and some vegetables and water and let it go all day, and it gives me a kind of basic, okay, decent turkey stock. I might even do it in a chicken stock that I have lying around in order to kind of give me a liquid with which I can moisten stuffing, with which I can moisten the pan if need be, with which I can make gravy, and with which I can warm up the sliced turkey before I send it out to the dining room. But you might, alternatively, when you pick up your turkey on Saturday, get a couple extra turkey legs or turkey wings, if those are available in the store, and roast those off on Saturday in order to have the base of a much more serious turkey stock. That's a pro move.
Okay.
You don't have to do
Nothing
it, but I find
that.
It to be absolutely delicious.
So one way or another, you've got that stock going. That's going to come in handy when the gravy time comes around, and for a lot of other sort of heating and moistening, as you remind us. And now we're looking at those side dishes. And where does your eye take you, Sam?
Well, I think there need to be a lot of side dishes. Multiple starches are okay. You can go on the caveman route and just do it with nuts and meats. But I think traditionally we've got these gourds that are coming into harvest. So they're going to be butternut squash is an excellent side dish. So too are Brussels sprouts, are green beans, are potatoes, both mashed and white and sweet and orange. The creamed onions are a big side dish in some parts of the country. Mac and cheese is a side dish in some parts of the country. You know, in that movie clip, I was thinking, you know, Waldor, I'm not a proponent of salad at all in this feast.
Now, why is that? People are so accustomed to bringing out the salad these days whenever there's big meal.
What's the point of that? There's no place for...
Well, it's cool, it's crisp, it kind of goes against all that hot, gloppy stuff on the plate.
Nah, I think... I like that Waldorf salad. That sounded kind of like it could fit on the plate. But I think that this kind of delicate, European, acidic green on the table. Most of those greens are now gone from gardens, so they come from elsewhere. Runs counter to the Thanksgiving larder, which is based in root vegetables, which is based in the bird and the gravy and the stuffing, and as you say, in these very 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 rich tastes and mouthfeels. Mm. So I do recognize that we want to have different textures on the plate, and this is why I advocate the use of, you know, some breadcrumbs on top of the Brussels sprouts in order to provide some texture. That's why I'm obsessive about the skin of the turkey. You do need to create contrast on the plate, but I do not think we need to go so far as to have a green salad.
Heaven forfend. Jane in Stowe, Massachusetts. Jane, you're on the air with Sam Sifton.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Hi, Sam.
Hi.
I'm calling as an advocate for homemade cranberry sauce rather than out of a can.
Hey, there's your contrast. Well, let's hear it, Jane. What's your case?
Oh, well, there's no comparing the two, and it's not hard to make, and you can make it a few days in advance and have it ready, and it's just as easy as making applesauce. You just, you know, it's so simple, and the flavor is
It's just
so
as fresh. Easy, Jane, as opening the can itself. It's so simple to make cranberry sauce. The thing about the canned cranberry sauce, and I understand the sort of nostalgia that is behind people's
love. That cylinder
of,
with the ribs and lines, yeah.
That's right, and the sound, that dog food sound that it makes as it comes out onto the plate, and how some moms and grandmoms cut them into coins to serve you as if it were
medallions.
And so this is reminder of our mechanized past, right? In the 50s, wow, you can can food. How exciting is this?
So what do you do with cranberries, Sam?
Well, I do pretty much what our caller does. I make a very, very simple and excellent cranberry sauce out of cranberries, sugar, and orange juice. And you can trick it out from there. You can put candied ginger in there. You can add nuts if you like. But this basic, simple astringency of the fruit, tempered by the sugar, tempered by the sweet of the orange juice, is just a fantastic almost chutney to go along with the meal. And it lacks that plasticine mouthfeel that you get from the high fructose corn syrup, which is what really makes the canned stuff taste the way it does.
Okay, we've got a lot going on here. We're going to come to stuffing, dressing. We're going to come to gravy. We're going to get to dessert. And the feeling in your kitchen, that your ideal sort of vibe is you've got this going on this big day of cooking, Sam, give us a sense.
Well, I get up quite early to get the thing going, and I treasure that sort of silent padding around the kitchen moment at the beginning of the day when the turkey just begins to give off its scent and the kids are waking up upstairs to the smell of a roasting turkey and quietly, sleepily coming downstairs to change the mood in this silent kitchen. And it's like it's the calm before the storm. And the storm will come. 20 people or more will be in your home tramping around, screwing things up. And you just have to you have to celebrate that. That's the point of the whole holiday. But my favorite moment is that early moment at the beginning of the day when all is quiet and I'm cooking alone.
I know exactly that moment you mean. It's talk about sacred. That's about as good as it gets. Sam Sifton's wonderful little book on Thanksgiving and how to do it right is Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. We've got excerpts at our website, onpointradio.org. And you're going to hear more right here. Dave Zobel sings Thanksgiving Day. You can join us. What's the special Thanksgiving tradition in your house? The dish, the moment you wait for. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Generations are come and gone. Lost loved ones we hold so dear. From the old to the very young, they always find a warm home here. Through it all, there's been ups and downs. Through it all, we did the best we could. Priorities get lost and found. The ones that matter stay the way they should. In time, it goes by so fast. The future soon becomes your past. Better take these special days, make them last. Thanksgiving Day.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. talking this hour about turkey and all the trimmings, advice for the Thanksgiving kitchen and beyond with Thanksgiving guru Sam Sifton, a kind of connoisseur of Thanksgiving. His new book is Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. And it's if you want a traditional Thanksgiving, this is a wonderful little guide. We've got the turkey in. We've got some stock going. We've got to the cranberries. We've got people howling for dressing and gravy ideas here, Sam. Brett says, there isn't anything I don't like about dressing, he writes at our website. Rolo says, oyster dressing, baby, oyster dressing. JG says, my folks always made a delicious stuffing with turkey, ham, and smoked sausage. He says, I'm starting to drool on my keyboard right now. Get a grip there, JG, get a grip. Let's go to dressing, Sam. How about it? Where do you go?
Well, I believe very strongly in dressing over stuffing. I don't really advocate stuffing the bird because not for health reasons, but because it kind of retards the cooking process a little bit.
You're saying whatever you call it, make it outside, cook it outside the bird?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you'll get more of it that way. I mean, I need a lot of dressing. I love dressing. I now want to add ham and smoked sausage to mine. I think it's a great side dish because it's a side dish that we don't eat all that often. We really only, as a culture, eat dressing once a year at Thanksgiving. And that mystifies me. We roast hundreds of millions of chickens every year. Mm-hmm. At other times of the year, we rarely cook dressing to go along with it. I wish that would change. You don't need much after all. You need some aromatic vegetables, some old bread. In the case of some of our listeners today, you need some meat. But in the case of many, many New Englanders, you just need some oysters as well. So the combination of these things, like a hash, essentially, made out of bread and flavorings. Oh, it's so perfect for this holiday.
How long in the oven for your dressing, your stuffing?
I like it to get a crisp exterior. That is to say, it's just getting brown and golden on top and then quite moist beneath it. And
so never a lid on yours or for a lid for a while or not at all?
You can go with a kind of tinfoil hat over it for a good 20 or 30 minutes. But the last, let's say 15, you take that off. Get some crunch on the top because, as we were discussing earlier, it's good to have some textural differences on the plate.
Okay, moment of truth. Let's get to the gravy. I think a lot of people have done Thanksgiving again and again and still don't have it down. Give us your gravy avenue here, Sam.
Gravy is a lot simpler than we allow it to be. We imbue it with a lot of drama and we worry about it, but we needn't really. You take the turkey, your roast turkey, out of the roasting pan in which you have cooked it, and you're going to allow that turkey to sit for a good half hour to reabsorb juices into its breasts and thighs, to set itself up. So that when you do carve it, it's not a literal hot mess with juices going everywhere. So you have a half hour to work with before anyone sits down at the table, a half hour at minimum before anyone sits down at the table. So look at this pan filled with funk and juice and stuff. This is the base of your gravy.
The good stuff.
I put the pan directly on the stovetop. I use one hand to
what across two burners or something. It's the big roasting pan.
It is a big roasting pan. Mm-hmm. We're only going to need one burner at first. Okay. I'm right-handed. I'm going to use my left hand to hold it up a little bit so that the juices all run down toward the right side, which is the burner that we'll be on. And using a wooden spoon, I'm scraping that stuff, which the chefs will tell you is called fond, and has they're like little flavor nuggets, little flavor bombs, all down into the right side of the pan. Stirring that around, and it's quite a fair amount of stuff. If it's not, you could add some butter to it, but I imagine it will be a fair amount of liquid and fat. And to this, I'm going to add a special kind of flour. I used to use, as most people do, all-purpose flour. Mm-hmm. And all-purpose flour causes problems for cooks because often it lumps up.
Too easily,
It's the disaster of a Thanksgiving.
Right. You turn to smash them all with the back of a spoon and there's 100,000 lumps.
Oh, it's so depressing when that happens. But it's easily avoidable because at the supermarket, there is a product. It's like an instant flour, they call it. It's a finely milled flour. That is to say, it's ground and ground and ground and ground again. It's not very good for baking. You wouldn't want it for cookies or cakes or pie or anything like that. But it is absolutely brilliant as a gravy thickener. So the instant flour, and there are various brand names for it. Wondra is one of them.
There's your secret. All right. So now we're getting the flour in there.
Oh, you get that flour in there. It thickens up the fat. You cook it for a while to get the raw taste of the flour down. And then add that serious turkey stock that you made earlier, or the turkey stock that you happen to have.
Sort of stirring it in slowly while the turkey is still sitting, waiting to cool off and set up a little bit. Yeah.
You're cool as a cucumber making your gravy. Stir, stir, stir. It's getting thicker. Maybe it's too thick. So we're going to add some cream maybe or more of that stock, depending what direction you want to go. I quite like adding some cream to it.
Yeah.
Salt, pepper. This elixir will fix any problem in your meal.
All right. It's all coming together here. You say when it comes time for carving, do not get that bird near the table and start doing all that hacking and sawing. Do it in the kitchen.
That's right. I make a lot out of the Rockwellian ideal of Thanksgiving. But one of the things that I want to avoid in that is this notion that the man of the house or the woman of the house should stand at the head of the table delicately carving the turkey. It's totally inefficient. It can be dangerous if you haven't done it a lot. It looks ugly. It doesn't yield the right amount of meat or the right cuts of meat. Forget it. Show them the beautiful bird. It's been resting. They had a half hour to look at this thing, by the way.
Right. Come out of the kitchen and see it. See it there. Maybe parade it a little bit, but take it back.
Take it back to your operating room, because one of the things you do want to do is take fully cut off both breasts and cut them against the grain.
Mm-hmm. So you can slice them well instead of them sort of falling apart as you take them off.
Yeah, you will thank me for that if you don't already
do it. Right, take them off. Marion in Norfolk, Virginia, you're on with Sam Sifton in New York. Marion.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I have a Thanksgiving dilemma. We love a brined turkey, but find the drippings unusual and unusable because of the salt. Does Sam have any suggestion?
What do you say, Sam? Well, two salty drippings off the brine.
Can I ask you what your brine ratio is, if you don't mind getting scientific? Are you using all salt, or are you using salt and sugar combined?
We are not using salt and sugar combined.
You're just using salt?
Yes.
Okay, so here's what I suggest. This year, why don't you go to, I'm guessing you were using a cup of salt per gallon. If you go down to a half cup of salt and half cup of sugar per gallon of brining liquid, I think you'll find those drippings a lot better and a lot less salty. And your bird, equally juicy and delicious.
There you go, Marion. There's your tip, and off to the good drippings. We hope you'll find yourself. Let's see, what have we not come to here? Dessert. Let us get you're a pretty straight ahead pie guy, I'm reading you here.
I think pie's crucial to this holiday. Once again, because what is it that you make so many pies you can't make a pie for this holiday? You have to now we're going to have a parfait or some chocolate indulgence. This is crazy talk. The fact of the matter is, on Thanksgiving we have apple pie. We have pumpkin pie. Perhaps if we're in the South or love Southerners, we have a pecan pie. But I simply do not understand the rush away from those three central dessert food groups toward other dishes. Pie is why we have Thanksgiving in the first place.
Make a beautiful table, you say, a gracious table. It is a kind of a sacred space on Thanksgiving Day. Not necessarily religious, but sacred in its own way. And then we come to the gathering itself. And here I read in your bio, Sam, you are the grandson of no less than Reinhold Niebuhr. Where do you say grace? Do you have the courage to say grace as the grandson of a theologian of such stature?
Well, I can hardly say it as well as he would have. But I do think that achieving a moment of grace at the table is important. And I say set the table as if for a sacrament. And I say that as the grandson of a theologian. And I say it for a particular reason. We need not be spiritual about what happens on Thanksgiving Day.
Though why not, if you like?
But I do think it's important to be religious about it. That is to say, the table should be set beautifully because it will alter, because an important thing will happen there, and because it will alter the behavior of those around it. Children are a little better behaved. Drunk uncles are a little less loquacious when there's a nice tablecloth down. And it need not be a nice tablecloth. It just needs to be a tablecloth. And there needs to be a moment at the very beginning of the meal when the host or the designated host takes that moment to look everyone in the eye around the table and offer thanks. Thanks to whom is up to you. It could be to God. It could be to a higher power. It could be to the farmer who brought us the turkey. It could be to the vegetables, to the friends, to all those, as Mary Chapin Carpenter sang earlier, each hand we hold around that table. But it must happen.
You know, it's been so great talking with you. I'll add one more prayer there, that this idea of bringing shopping into Thanksgiving Day fades away. Please let that fade away. Let's try. If not this year, then let's get back there next year and hold this day sacred for all this companionship and fellowship and food. Can I get an amen on that, Sam?
Amen. Blue laws forever.
For Thanksgiving Day. We're going to hear from Rick Bragg, Sam Sifton, author of Thanksgiving, How to Cook It Well. Our deep thanks to you and very happy Thanksgiving, Sam.
Happy Thanksgiving to you, Tom. Thank you.
In a moment, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Rick Bragg on saying grace before the Thanksgiving meal. This is On Point. As a child, Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Rick Bragg remembers how long it took to get through Thanksgiving grace as he waited to dig into the meal sitting so fragrantly in front of him. Here he shares his essay, Never-Ending Grace, from Southern Living magazine.
When I was a little boy, the word seemed to last forever. It seemed like we were walking the Exodus ourselves, one paragraph at a time. Surely, I figured, thousands of little boys had starved to death between the words, "Let us pray," and "Amen." The bad thing was, from where I sat, my hands clasped but one eye open, I could see it all, and more than that, I could smell it all. This wonderful feast laid out hot and steaming. Thanksgiving, my favorite day on the calendar. Better than the 4th of July, Halloween, and President's Day all lumped into one. The pinto beans bubbled in the battered pot, molten with the fat from big chunks of ham. Hot biscuits rested under a warm towel. Mashed potatoes, creamed onions, cornbread dressing, sweet potatoes, macaroni and cheese, all waited, each one sending its own perfume wafting through the house. And in the middle of it all sat the big turkey, its sides trickling with melted butter and specked with black pepper. So close, why, a drumstick was just a side step and a quick grab away, and yet so far. But it would all be cold as a Confederate statue on Christmas morning by the time we got any of it. Between me and all this bounty stretched what we have called and will always call the blessing. It consisted, as near as I could tell, of reading the King James Bible from front to back and then holding a discussion on its finer points. While I now see the beauty in those words and in this tradition, I was an ungrateful heathen back then, thinking only of my belly and my own little self. Now, before anyone fires off an angry letter pointing out the heathenness I've already confessed to, I've learned that admitting to such things in some preemptive hope just makes people mad at you for robbing them of the opportunity to flog you unencumbered. Let me say that I know how selfish and ignorant I was to wish for a shorter blessing, a more truncated thanks. I know. I get it. I was a bad child, but I was suffering. I grew up with the Pentecostals, and they do not have a short blessing in their lexicon. They are not like some denominations that see prayer as a fixed ritual. The Congregational Holiness go to town on a prayer, and they do not turn loose of one till they have wrung it dry. So I suffered. Sometimes they would have a child do the blessing, and I would go hopeful, because surely they would not have so many words at their disposal, and older ladies would pat the good child when he was done and say, "How precious." But I came to know that this was only a warm-up for the main event, and that a grown-up, a deacon even, would take over and close the show. What would happen, I once wondered, if I just broke down in the middle of the litany of things we were thankful for and snatched a wing? I could be halfway across the pasture and into the deep woods before they ran me down. But it was too awful, the eventual consequences, to even talk about with nice people. So I suffered. Now, it's one of those things I wait for all year. My Uncle John does the blessing now, and he is a man of honor and brings to us a gentle message of great warmth and dignity. It is a simple prayer of thanks for this one day, for the grace that has allowed us to gather here for one more year. I think anyone of any faith, or of no faith at all, would see great value in it. It is never too long, his message. Though the older and older I get, it is sometimes over much too soon.
Rick Bragg is professor of journalism at the University of Alabama, contributing editor at Southern Living Magazine. You can read his essay, Never Ending Grace, at our website, onpointradio.org. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Thank you.